Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally, 7 days a week, here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on lies that my teacher told me. You know, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. while his coffee pot made in Japan is perking. He puts his blow dryer, made in Taiwan, to work, and then he shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan. His designer jeans are made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. And then after cooking up some breakfast on his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator made in Mexico how much he can spend today. Then after setting his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany, goes looking as he has for months for a good-paying American job. Then after the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV made in Japan, then ponders again why it is that he can't find a good-paying American job. Well, I would say that instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? And if you'd like to tap into the power of private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number's 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, why don't you go to my website, that's georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Why don't you do that right now before you forget? All right, last time we were talking about this book called Lies That My Teacher Told Me. History is written by the winners. And history is a system of deliberate lies. History is for political purposes, and history was never intended for the masses. The truth of history is buried under a morass of lies. I didn't tell you anything that you didn't already know. But when somebody actually brings it to your attention and says, did you know that Abraham Lincoln actually intended to free the slaves when he was elected in 1860? Most people say, no. I read my history book. He was kind of neutral on the question. And here's what he said. And you know, we've already seen in the last program, yes, they quoted right out of Lincoln's mouth, but they didn't read you the whole story. And one of the basic methodologies of deception is lying by omission. We tell you what the guy said, but we don't tell you what he said as a part of the original context. This is called quoting out of context, or it's off point and out of context. When Abraham Lincoln was making his second inaugural address, he said, fondly do we hope and fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all of the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said today. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Would you have thought Abraham Lincoln to be that eloquent? Would you have thought Abraham Lincoln in his inaugural address would have used the Bible and the name of God as a part and parcel of his public policy? He said, this last is an astonishing sentence. Its length alone astounds. Politicians don't talk like that anymore. When students read this passage aloud, slowly and deliberately, they do not fail to perceive that it is a searing indictment of America's sins against black people. The Civil War was by far the most devastating experience in our nation's history, and yet we had it coming, Lincoln says here. And in his rhetorical context, sin or crime, not mere tragedy, is the fitting and proper term. Indeed, this indictment of U.S. race relations echoes John Brown's last note. Remember John Brown? He said, I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away, but with blood. Unquote. Well, Lincoln's second inaugural made such an impact on Americans that when the president was shot just 1 month later, farmers in New York and Ohio greeted his funeral train with placards bearing its phrases. But only the United States, a history of the Republic, includes any of the material that I just quoted here. Five other textbooks restrict their quotation to the speech's final phrase about binding up the nation's wounds and with malice toward none. The other six textbooks ignore the speech altogether. Is it any wonder that we Americans have a skewered view of the world today? America is a nation of historical illiterates. I include myself in that group. I'm not here to hold myself up above everybody else. I just wanted to bring to your attention the fact that we've been lied to a lot. I don't think George Bush, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, or Dick Cheney and the government officials are telling us all of the truth on a day-to-day basis today, much less when we come back 30, 50, or 100 years from now and review the American-Iraq War. I don't think that we get the truth in the news today, do you? Well, if you don't get the truth in the news, where do you think the historians are going to get their facts and figures for writing the history books in the future? Now, it is true that there were some Southern historians that wrote their versions of the Civil War, but here's the winning side's version of the Civil War, and it doesn't include all of the facts. And this author is going through a number of textbooks taught in our colleges and high schools, and he's pointing out to us that, hey, listen, we're not getting the whole story. It isn't that the congressional record, it isn't that these quotations from Lincoln or John Brown and others aren't available. They're available to people that want to search them out. But high school students in the 9th, 10th, 11th, or 12th grades, college freshmen or sophomores, do not do historical research to find out these facts. They read the popular textbooks that are in the schools for which they get credits. After all, a man's going to college not because he wants to learn history, but because he wants to get a job at Exxon, Mobil, or Microsoft. And after all, why does he have to know anything about history anyway? Like Helen Keller's concern about the injustice of social classes, Lincoln's concern about the crime of racism may appear unseemly to textbook authors today. Now, must we remember Lincoln for that? Let's leave that out, the author will say. Such an approach to Lincoln might be called the Walt Disney interpretation. Disney's exhibit at the 1964 New York World's Fair featured an animated sculpture of Lincoln that spoke for several minutes, choosing his words carefully, to say nothing about slavery. Having disconnected Abraham Lincoln from considerations of right and wrong, several textbooks present the Civil War the same way. In reality, United States soldiers who began fighting to save the Union, and nothing more, ended by fighting for all of the vague but portentous ideas in the Gettysburg Address. From 1862 on, Union armies sang Battle Cry of Freedom, composed by George Root in the summer of that year. Surely no one can sing these lines even today without perceiving that both freedom and the preservation of the Union were the primary aims of the United States, and without feeling some of the power of that potent combination. This power is what textbooks omit, and they give their students no inkling that ideas really matter. The actions of African Americans played a big role in challenging white racism. Slaves fled to Union lines, and after they were allowed to fight, the contributions of black troops to the war effort made it harder for whites to deny that blacks were, in fact, really, fully human. A Union captain wrote to his wife. He said, quote, "A great many whites have the idea that the entire Negro race are vastly their inferiors. A few weeks of calm, unprejudiced life here would disabuse them, I think. I have a more elevated opinion of their abilities than I ever had before." Unlike historians of a few decades ago, today's textbook authors realize that trying to present the war without the actions of African Americans makes for bad history. All 12 current textbooks at least mention that more than 180,000 blacks fought for the Union Army and Navy. Several of the textbooks include an illustration of African American soldiers and describe the unequal pay that they received until late in the war. Discovering American History mentions that Union soldiers trapped behind Confederate lines found slaves to be of invaluable assistance. Only the United States, a history of the Republic, takes the next step by pointing out how the existence and success of black troops decreased white racism. The anti-racist repercussions of the Civil War were particularly apparent in the border states. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation applied only to the Confederacy. It left slavery untouched in the Union states of Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, but the war did not. The status of planters became ambiguous. Owning black people was no longer what a young white man aspired to do or what a young white woman aspired to accomplish by marriage. Maryland was a slave state with considerable support for the Confederacy at the onset of the war. But Maryland held for the Union and sent thousands of soldiers to defend Washington. What happened next provides a positive example of the effects of cognitive dissonance. For Maryland, whites to fight a war against slave owners while allowing slavery within their own state created a tension that demanded resolution. In 1864, the increasingly persuasive abolitionists in Maryland brought the issue to a vote. Well, the tally went narrowly against emancipation until the large number of absentee ballots were counted. Then, by an enormous margin, these ballots were for emancipation of the slaves. Who cast most of these absentee ballots in the 1864 election? Soldiers and sailors, of course. Just as these soldiers marched into battle with John Brown's body upon their lips, so their minds had changed to favor the freedom of their actions, that their actions were forging. And as noted in the previous chapter, songs such as Nigger Doodle Dandy reflect the racist tone of the Democrats' presidential campaign in 1864. How did the Republicans counter? Well, in part, they sought white votes by being anti-racist. The Republican campaign, boosted by military victories in the fall of 1864, proved very effective. The Democrats' overt appeals to racism failed, and anti-racist Republicans triumphed almost everywhere. One New York Republican wrote, "The change of opinion on this slavery question is a great and historic fact. Who could have predicted this great and blessed revolution? People around the world supported the Union because of its ideology. 40,000 Canadians alone, some of them black, came south to volunteer for the Union cause." Now, blacks vote Democratic today by a percentage of over 9-1. It wasn't the Democratic Party that freed the slaves, nor was it the Democratic Party who was the anti-racist party. How did that get turned around? How is it today that the blacks are voting for the very Democratic Party that was so racist in the 1864 election? The vagaries of politics. Well, ideas made the opposite impact on the Confederacy. Ideological contradictions affected the slave system even before the war began. You see, John Brown knew that masters secretly feared that their slaves might revolt, even as they assured abolitionists that slaves really liked slavery. One reason that his Harper's Ferry raid prompted such an outcry in the South was that the slave owners themselves feared that their slaves might join him. And yet their condemnations of Brown and the black Republicans who financed him did not persuade Northern moderates, but only pushed them toward the abolitionist camp. After all, if Brown was truly dangerous, as slave owners claimed, then slavery was truly unjust. After all, happy slaves would never revolt, would they? Now, white Southerners founded the Confederacy on the ideology of white supremacy. According to Alexander Stephens, vice president of the Confederacy, "Our new government's foundations are laid. Its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition." Confederate soldiers on their way to Antietam and Gettysburg, their two main forays into Union states, put this ideology into practice, and they seized scores of free black people in Maryland and Pennsylvania and sent them south into slavery. Confederates maltreated black Union troops when they captured them. And throughout the war, the protection of slavery had been and still remained the central core of Confederate purpose. Textbooks downplay all of this today, probably because they do not want to offend white Southerners today. The safeguarding of states' rights, often mentioned as a motive for the establishment of the Confederacy, was, for the most part, merely an accompanying rationale. Historically, whatever faction has been out of power in America has pushed for states' rights. Slave owners were delighted when Supreme Court Chief Justice Taney decided in 1857 that throughout the nation, irrespective of the wishes of state or territorial governments, blacks had no rights that whites must respect. Slave owners pushed President Buchanan to use federal power to legitimize slaveholding in Kansas the very next year. Only after they lost control of the executive branch in the 1860 election did they advocate limiting federal power. Now, we hear a lot today about states' rights, don't we? And limiting federal power. Gee, isn't it surprising that the limitations on federal power kind of move like a pendulum depending upon who's got that power, don't they? Hang on, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush, both senior and junior back in 1992 and in 2000, kept telling us that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in employment, and it's certainly not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. You see, the money is in private business and sales. It's not in public business and jobs, jobs, jobs. And it's time that you and I cashed in on our inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the old covenant contract and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD, Home School for Adults, and while you're at it, order my free General Law CD package at the same time. Just call and order for it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative. It's entertaining. It's educational, and it's free of charge, and you can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? You know, as the war, this is the Civil War now, continued, neither the states' rights nor white supremacy proved adequate to the task of inspiring a new nation. As early as December of 1862, President Jefferson Davis denounced states' rights as being destructive to the Confederacy. The mountainous counties in western Virginia revolted and bolted to the Union side. Confederate troops had to occupy East Tennessee to keep it from emulating West Virginia. Wynn Parish in Louisiana refused to secede from the Union, and Winston County, Alabama declared itself the Republic of Winston. Unionist farmers and woodsmen in Jones County, Mississippi declared the Free State of Jones, and every Confederate state except South Carolina supplied a regiment, or at least a company, of white soldiers to the Union Army, as well as many black recruits. Now, armed guerrilla actions plagued every Confederate state with the exception of Missouri and the 1863 New York City draft riots, and few Union states were affected with any of these kinds of problems. It became dangerous for Confederates to travel in parts of Alabama, Florida, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas. The war was fought not just between North and South, but between Unionists and Confederates within the Confederacy and Missouri. By February of 1864, President Davis despaired. He said, public meetings of treasonable character in the name of state sovereignty are being held. Thus, states' rights as an ideology was contradictory and could not mobilize the white South for the long haul in the Civil War. When did you ever read a story like that in your history textbooks concerning the Civil War? Now, the racial ideas of the Confederate states proved even less serviceable to the war effort. According to Confederate ideologies, blacks liked slavery. But nevertheless, to avoid revolts and runaways, the Confederate states passed the 20-nigger law, exempting from military conscription one white man as overseer for every 20 slaves. And throughout the war, Confederates withheld as much as a third of their fighting forces from the front lines and scattered those forces throughout areas with large slave populations to prevent slave uprisings. And when the United States allowed African Americans to enlist, Confederates were forced by their ideology to assert that it would not work. Blacks would hardly fight like white men. The undeniable bravery of the 54th Massachusetts and other black regiments disproved the idea of black inferiority. Then came the incongruity of truly beastly behavior by southern whites toward captured black soldiers, such as the infamous Fort Pillow massacre by troops under Nathan Bedford Forrest, who crucified black prisoners on tent frames and then burned them alive. And they did all of this in the name of Christianity and preserving white civilization. Contradiction piled upon contradiction. After the fall of Vicksburg, President Davis proposed to arm slaves to fight for the Confederacy, promising them freedom to win their cooperation. But if servitude was the best condition for the slave, protested supporters of slavery, how could freedom then become a reward? To win foreign recognition, other Confederate leaders proposed to abolish slavery altogether. Some newspaper editors concurred, although slavery is one of the principles that we started to fight for, said the Jackson Mississippian. If it must be jettisoned to achieve our separate nationality, then away with it. Then a month before Appomattox, the Confederate Congress passed a measure to enroll black troops, showing how the war had elevated even slaveholders and their estimations of black abilities, and also revealed complete ideological disarray. What, after all, would the new black soldiers be fighting for? Would they be fighting for slavery? Would they be fighting for secession? What, for that matter, would white Southern troops be fighting for? You see, once the blacks were also armed, as Howell Cobb of Georgia said, if slaves will make good soldiers, then our whole theory of slavery must be wrong. In part, owing to these contradictions, some Confederate soldiers switched sides, beginning as early as 1862. When Sherman made his famous march to the sea from Atlanta to Savannah, his army actually grew in number because thousands of white Southerners volunteered along the way. Meanwhile, almost two-thirds of the Confederate army opposing Sherman disappeared through desertion. 18,000 slaves also joined Sherman, so many that the army had to turn some of them away. Now compare these facts with the portrait common in our textbooks of Sherman's marauders looting their way through a united South. You see, the increasing ideological confusion in the Confederate states, coupled with the increasing ideological strength of the United States, helps explain the Union victory. Even with all of the hardships, Carlton Beals was noted to say that the South, up to the very end, had all of the great resources and manpower that it had at the beginning of the war. Many nations and people have continued to fight with far inferior means and weapons. Beals thinks that the Confederacy's ideological contradictions were its gravest liabilities. Ultimately, it caused their defeat. And he shows how the Confederate Army was disbanding by the spring of 1865 in Texas and other states, even in the absence of Union armies approaching their states. And on the home front, too, as Jefferson Davis puts it, the zeal of the people is failing. Five textbooks tell how the issue of states' rights interfered with the Confederate cause. Only the American Adventure gives students a clue of any other ideological weaknesses in the Confederacy or the ideological strength of the Union. Adventure tells how slavery broke down when Union armies came near and that many poor whites in the South did not support the war because they felt that they would be fighting for slave owners. Adventure also quotes original sources on the evolution of Union war aims and asks, how would such attitudes affect the conduct and the outcome of the war? No other textbook mentions ideas or ideologies as a strength or weakness for either side. The Civil War was about something, after all. Textbooks should tell us what it was for, shouldn't they? Now, if you'll notice in the present war with Iraq, America's about evenly divided on their view of the war. Some are for it and some are against it. About 50-50 in round numbers. The Bush administration, at this juncture of time, is telling us why they're in favor of it. We removed this terrible tyrant, and we're fighting the war in Iraq instead of fighting it in downtown Chicago, New York, or Los Angeles, like the Russians are doing. You see, the Russians are fighting the same kind of insurgency in Russia from the Chechen rebels that we're fighting with Al-Qaeda here in the rest of the world. The Democrats, by John Kerry and John Edwards, by comparison, are not anti-war. In fact, they're pro-war, but their pro-war says, well, we would fight the war differently. And if we're elected, we'll prosecute the war just like the Republicans and George Bush, but we'll do it more effectively, and we'll do a better job of it. I'm not so sure that George Bush is doing a bad job of fighting the war right now. And this was the conclusion that Americans came to in 1864 when they had to choose between Lincoln and a very unpopular war. Nobody, North or South, was in favor of the Civil War. Well, I shouldn't say no one. I suppose there were a few people there that were in favor of it. But by and large, people were not in favor of going out and killing each other, especially Americans. But there was an ideological rift there, and it was over slavery. It wasn't the total picture. And we should keep in mind that there were some other things, like four states in the South furnished the United States of America with 50% of the total revenue that came into the federal government. The South was immensely rich, powerful, prosperous, underpopulated, and they didn't have industry. Yeah, there were problems over slavery, there were problems over economics, there were problems over states' rights. But those problems had always been worked out in the past, but now an ideological concept came into play, and it ripped the Confederacy apart, and it strengthened the Union, and it was over slavery. Well, when was the last time somebody explained that point to you? Now, the silence has a history, and throughout this century, textbooks have presented the Civil War as a struggle between virtually identical peoples. This is all part of the unspoken agreement reached during the low point of race relations in the United States between 1890 and 1920, that whites in the South were as American as whites in the North, and white Northerners and white Southerners reconciled on the blacks of African Americans, or on the backs, I should say, of African Americans, while the abolitionists became the bad guys. In the 1920s, the Grand Army of the Republic, the Organization of Union Veterans, complained that American history textbooks presented the Civil War with no suggestion that the Union cause was right. Apparently, the United Daughters of the Confederacy carried more weight with the publishers. The UDC was even able to erect a statue to a Confederate dead in Wisconsin, claiming that they died to repel unconstitutional invasion to protect the rights reserved to the people to perpetuate the sovereignty of the states. Not a word about slavery. Not a word about disunion. Historical textbooks still present Union and Confederate sympathizers as equally idealistic. The North fought to hold the Union together while the Southern states fought, according to the American way, for the preservation of their rights and freedom to decide for themselves. Nobody fought to preserve racial slavery. Nobody fought to end it. As one result, unlike the Nazi swastika, which lies disgraced even in the North, whites still proudly display the stars and bars of the Confederacy on den walls, license plates, t-shirts, and high school logos. Even some white Northerners vaguely regret the defeat of the lost cause. It's as if racism against blacks could be remembered with nostalgia. And in this sense, long after Appomattox, the Confederacy finally won. 5 days after Appomattox, President Lincoln was murdered. His martyrdom pushed Union ideology one step further. Even whites who had opposed emancipation now joined to call Lincoln the Great Emancipator. Under Republican leadership, the nation entered Reconstruction, a period of continuing ideological conflict. At first, Confederates tried to maintain pre-war conditions through new laws modeled after their slave codes and antebellum restrictions on free blacks. Mississippi was the first state to pass these draconian black codes, and they did not work. The Civil War had changed American ideology. The new anti-racism forged in its flames would dominate Northern thinking for more than a decade. The Chicago Tribune, the most important organ of the Republican Party in the Midwest, responded angrily. "We tell the white men of Mississippi that the men of the North will convert the state of Mississippi into a frog pond before they will allow any such laws to disgrace 1 foot of soil on which the bones of our soldiers sleep and over which the flag of freedom waves." Pretty boisterous statement, wouldn't you say? Thus, black civil rights again became the central issue in the congressional elections of 1866. "Support Congress and you support the Negro," said the Democrats in the campaign broadside featuring a disgusting caricature of an African American. "Sustain the president and you protect the white man." Northern voters didn't buy it, and they returned radical Republicans to Congress in a thunderous repudiation of President Andrew Johnson's accommodation of the ex-Confederates. Even more than in 1864, when Republicans swept the Congress in 1866, anti-racism became the policy of the nation, agreed to by most of its voters. Over Johnson's veto, Congress and the states passed the 14th Amendment, making all persons citizens and guaranteeing them the equal protection of the laws. The passage on behalf of blacks of the shining jewel of our Constitution shows how idealistic were the office holders of the Republican Party, particularly when we consider that similar legislation on behalf of women cannot even be passed today. Referring, of course, to the Equal Rights Amendment, which is another subject for another day, and I'm not here to expunge racism or equal rights, but simply to point out that in the book Lies My Teacher Told Me are some surprises that perhaps you'd never heard before. Thought I'd share it with you. Hang on, we'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10, it says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, but public business is conducted in commercial paper like stocks, bonds, and Federal Reserve notes. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin and currency. And that is true when you're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on the paper money that's not due on the gold. Now, you know, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew, and they knew as a matter of law, that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate us, a free people, they would first have to take away our gold and silver coin, which is what they did, so that they could extinguish our right to property and destroy our property rights under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. And they did. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now let me show you how to do just that. And this is a part of my business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschool. Now for more information about my private business school, why don't you just call and order my free general law CD package first. Now that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's free. You can call right now to order yours, the number 417-273-4967. And my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're reviewing Lies My Teacher Told Me, written by James Loewen, published by New York Press, copyright 1995. Probably get a copy of Barnes & Noble. We won't be able to read the whole book, obviously, but we can cover some of the excerpts out of it. And right now we're covering the excerpts that cover John Brown and Abraham Lincoln with some portions of the Civil War. Well, during Reconstruction, a surprising variety of people went to the new civilian front lines and worked among the newly freed African Americans in the South. Many of these people, black Northerners, including several graduates of Oberlin College. This passage came from a letter by Edmonia Highgate, a white woman who went south to teach school, and she describes her life in Lafayette Parish, Louisiana. She said, "The majority of my pupils come from plantations, 3, 4, or even 8 miles distance. So anxious are they to learn that they walk these distances so early in the morning as never to be tardy. There has been much opposition to school, and since I have been shot in my room, my night school scholars have been shot but none killed. A week ago, an aged freedman just across the way was shot so badly as to break his arm and leg. The rebels here threatened to burn down the school and the house in which I board, yet they have not materially harmed us as yet. The nearest military protection is 200 miles distance at New Orleans." Unquote. Some Union soldiers stayed in the South when they were demobilized. Some Northern Republican would-be politicians moved South to organize their party in a region where it had not been a factor before the war. Some went hoping to win office by election or appointment. Some abolitionists continued their commitment by working in the Freedmen's Bureau and private organizations to help blacks obtain their full civil and political rights. In terms of party affiliation, almost all of these persons were Republicans. Otherwise, they were a diverse group. Still, all but one of the 12 textbooks routinely used the disgraceful old tag carpetbaggers without noting its bias to describe Northern white Republicans who lived in the South during Reconstruction. Many whites who were born in the South supported Reconstruction, and every Southern state boasted Unionists, some of whom had volunteered for the Union Army. They now became Republicans. Some former Confederates, including even General James Longstreet, second in command under Lee at Gettysburg, became Republicans because they had grown convinced that equality for blacks was, in fact, morally right. Robert Flournoy, a Mississippi planter, had raised a company of Confederate soldiers, but then resigned his commission and returned home because there was a conflict in my conscience. During the war, he was once arrested for encouraging blacks to flee to Union lines. And during Reconstruction, he helped organize the Republican Party, published a newspaper called Equal Rights, and argued for desegregating the University of Mississippi and the new state's public school system. Republican policies, including free public education, never before available in the South to children of either race, convinced some poor whites to vote for the party. Some former Whigs became Republicans rather than join their old nemesis, the Democrats. Some white Southerners became Republicans because they were convinced that black suffrage was an accomplished fact. They preferred winning political power with blacks on their side to losing. Others became Republicans to make connections or win contracts from the new Republican state governments. And of the 113 white Republican congressmen from the South during Reconstruction, 53 were Southerners, many of them from wealthy families. In sum, this is another diverse group amounting to between one-fourth and one-third of the white population, and in some counties they constituted a majority. Nevertheless, all but one textbook still routinely apply this disgraceful old tag, scallywags, to Southern white Republicans. Carpetbaggers and scallywags are terms coined by white Southern Democrats to defame their opponents as illegitimate. Reconstruction-era newspapers in Mississippi, at least, used Republicans far more often than carpetbaggers or scallywags. Carpetbagger implies that the dregs of Northern society, carrying all their belongings in a carpetbag, had come down to make their fortunes off of the prostrate white South. Scalawag means scoundrel. Employing these terms would be appropriate if textbook authors made clear that they were terms of the time and explained who used them and in what circumstances. But these textbooks incorporate them as if they were proper historical labels with no quotation marks in preference to neutral terms such as Reconstruction Republican. Consider these sentences from the United States. It's a history of the Republic. It says, quote, "In Mississippi, the carpetbaggers control politics. In Tennessee, the scallywags did." Or this came from the American tradition. Quote, "Despite Southern white claims to the contrary, the radical regimes were not dominated by blacks, but by scallywags and carpetbaggers." In reality, scalawags were Southern whites, of course, but this sentence writes them out of the white South, just as diehard Confederates were wont to do. Moreover, referring to perfectly legal governments as regimes is a way of delegitimizing them. After all, that's what we call the Saddam Hussein government. Wasn't it called a regime? It's a technique or a tradition that applies to no other administration, not even the 1836 Republic of Texas or the 1893 Dole Pineapple takeover in Hawaii, which overthrew the monarchy of the Hawaiians. Now, to be sure, newer editions of American history textbooks no longer denounce Northerners who participated in Southern politics and society as dishonest adventurers whose only thought was to feather their own nests at the expense of their fellows. As the textbook Rise of the American Nation put it in 1961, again, the civil rights movement has allowed us to rethink our history. Having watched Northerners, black and white, go south to help blacks win civil rights in the 1960s, today's textbook authors display more sympathy for Northerners who worked with the Southern blacks during Reconstruction after the Civil War. Here's the paragraph on carpetbaggers from Rise's successor, Triumph of the American Nation. It says, quote, "The carpetbaggers came for many different reasons. Some sincerely wanted to help the freed slaves exercise their newly acquired rights. Some hoped to get themselves elected to political office. Some came to make their fortunes by acquiring farmland or by starting new businesses. However, some came for reasons of pure greed or fraud. Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, wrote that such carpetbaggers were stealing and plundering, many of them with both arms around the Negroes and their hands in their rear pockets, seeing if they cannot pick a paltry dollar out of them," unquote. Now here's a paragraph on scalawags. It says, "Some of these native-born Southerners had the best of motives, having opposed slavery and secession. They had sympathized with the Union during the war. Now they believed that the best way to restore peace and prosperity to the South and to the nation was to forgive and forget. However, others were selfish and ambitious. They were individuals who seized any opportunity to advance their own fortunes at the expense of their neighbors." The new treatment is a little kinder. The authors are trying to be positive about white Republicans, even if they cannot resist ending each paragraph by invoking greed. Of course, textbook authors might use the notion of private gain to disparage every textbook hero from Christopher Columbus and the Pilgrims through George Washington to Jackie Robinson. They don't, though. Textbooks attribute selfish motives only to characters with whom they have little sympathy, such as the idealists in the Reconstruction era. The negatives then stick in your mind, cemented by the catchy pejoratives like carpetbaggers and scalawags. While the qualifying phrases, "some sincerely wanted," are likely to be forgotten. Like John Brown was crazy. No textbook introduces us to idealists such as Edmonia Highgate, facing down white violence, or Robert Florney, casting his lot with black Republicans because he believed in justice. Everyone who supported black rights in the South during Reconstruction did so at great personal risk. At the beginning of Reconstruction, simply to walk to school to teach could be life-threatening. Toward the end of the era, there were communities in which simply to vote Republican was life-threatening. While some Reconstructionists undoubtedly achieved economic gain, it was a dangerous way to make a living. Textbooks need to show that risk and the racial idealism that prompted most of these people who took those risks. Instead, textbooks deprive us of our racial idealists from Highgate and Forney, whom they omit through John Brown, whom they make to be a fanatic or crazy, to Lincoln, whose idealism they totally flatten or ignore. As a result, in the course of events, Lincoln would come to accomplish on a national scale what John Brown tried to accomplish at Harper's Ferry, helping African Americans mobilize to fight slavery. Finally, like John Brown, Abraham Lincoln became a martyr and a hero. 7 million Americans, almost one-third of the entire Union population, stood to watch his funeral train pass. African Americans mourned with particular intensity. Gideon Welles, Secretary of the Navy, walked the streets of Washington at dawn an hour before the president breathed his last and described the scene. He said, "The colored people especially, and there were at this time more and more of them, perhaps even more than of whites, they were overwhelmed with grief." Welles went on to tell how all day long on the avenue in front of the White House were several hundred black people, mostly women and children, weeping for the loss, a crowd that did not appear to diminish through the whole of the cold, wet day. In their grief, African Americans were neither misguided nor were they childlike. When the hour came for dealing with slavery, as Lincoln had surmised, he had done his duty and it had cost him his life. Abraham Lincoln, racism and all, was blacks and the black people's legitimate hero, as earlier John Brown had been. In a sense, Brown and Lincoln were even killed for the same deed, arming black people for their own liberation. People around the world mourned the passing of both men. But when I ask my white college students on the first day of class who their heroes are in American history, Only one or two in 100 will pick Lincoln. Even those who choose Lincoln know only that he was really great, but they haven't got a clue as to why he was great. Their ignorance makes sense. After all, textbooks present Abraham Lincoln almost devoid of any content. No students choose John Brown, not a one. No one has even ever named a white abolitionist or a Reconstruction Republican or a civil rights martyr, and yet these same students feel sympathy with America's struggle to improve race relations. Among their more popular choices are African Americans, from Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass to Rosa Parks and Malcolm X. While John Brown was on trial, the abolitionist Wendell Phillips spoke of Brown's place in history. Phillips foresaw that slavery was a cause whose time was passing, and he asked the American people of the future, when slavery was long dead in the civilization of the 20th century, this question. He said, when that day comes, what will be thought of these first martyrs who teach us how to live and how to die? Phillips meant the question rhetorically. He never dreamed that Americans would take no pleasure in those who had helped lead the nation to abolish slavery, or that textbooks would label Brown's small band as misguided fanatics and crazy. Anti-racism is one of America's great gifts to the world. Its relevance extends far beyond race relations. Anti-racism led to a new birth of freedom after the Civil War, not only for African Americans. Twice, once in each century, the movement for black rights triggered the movement for women's rights. Twice it reinvigorated our democratic spirit, which had been atrophying away. Throughout the world, from South Africa to Northern Ireland, movements of oppressed people continue to use tactics and words borrowed from our abolitionist and our civil rights movements. Well, we don't hear much of that anymore, especially in history. We have what we call in America revisionist history. We don't hear the truth about World War I, World War II, Korea, or the Civil War, or John Brown, or race religion, or race relations, I should say. Why is it that we don't hear the truth about our own history? Well, we'll be back with more, and we'll tell you why as we progress along. It's not an accident. It's done on purpose. Well, we've got to leave it right there. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, that's the signal. It's my time. It's up. We'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.